Hello and welcome to the Brown Bagger program right here on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. It's your radio station, and here is a voice of our own.
Hello, I'm Severin Suzuki speaking for ECHO, the Environmental Children's Organization. We're a group of 12 and 13-year-olds trying to make a difference. We've raised all the money to come here ourselves, to come 5,000 miles to tell you adults you must change your ways. Coming up here today, I have no hidden agenda. I am fighting for my future. Losing my future is not like losing an election or a few points on the stock market.
Many of us wait and fondly hope for a revolution of the young, demanding action to save the climate, the species, and ourselves. Severin Collis Suzuki spoke to the assembled nations of the world at the United Nations Environment Conference in 1992. As a representative voice for the children of the world, she called the adults to action. Now, as a young woman, Severin spoke to a gathering of school trustees, principals, and educators in Vancouver, Canada. It was a rare public appearance for the daughter of famous broadcaster and naturalist David Suzuki. Severin is a scientist in her own right, now living in Haida Gwaii, formerly known as the Queen Charlotte Islands, off the north coast of British Columbia. It was a keynote speech for the luncheon organized by the Columbia Institute Center for Civic Governance. The meeting was called Through the Green Glass, a Climate Symposium for Education Leaders. The date was January 24, 2008. Here is Severin Collis Suzuki.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm so glad to be here today. I'd like to begin simply by acknowledging the Musqueam First Nations on whose traditional territory we're on today, and by telling you that I am extremely honored to be speaking to such a group of people. I'm honored to be speaking to a group of people whose work is to facilitate and structure the education and therefore the mindset of the next generation. Education is the foundation upon how our society organizes and functions and ultimately contributes to the greater human whole. It gives integral structure in our culture. So today the theme of your symposium is Through the Green Glass, Climate Change Symposium for Education Leaders. And it seems to me that schools really are the first places in our society that should emerge as examples of sustainability. I mean, the most obvious reason is because schools are built for the future. They're about teaching the next generation. And today, by necessity, we need to become sustainable. Learning this attitude and means of doing it in the school institution will set up future adults for the practical reality of living with smaller ecological footprints. And this has already been happening in schools. I mean, ever since I was in school, kids were being taught about the environment and taught about recycling and reducing. Because of this, schools and institutions of learning should be places of innovation in sustainability. And the example that immediately springs to my mind is of Cochrane High School. Has anybody heard of Cochrane? Raise your hands. Okay, so quite a few of you have heard about this amazing school in Alberta, in Cochrane, Alberta. And this school, because of two science teachers who were inspired, they started a sustainable development project, got the kids on board, and they raised enough money and innovation to insert a wind turbine and solar panels on top of their school. And it's amazing. I've been to their school, and you go in the lobby, and there's a whole computer system and a case display where you can actually see how much energy the wind turbine and solar panels are generating for the school and how much energy the school actually needs. So it's this amazing learning tool that the kids are incredibly proud of. And the neatest thing about that was I actually ran into kids from this school at a sustainability conference. Those kids were doing a workshop. they were teaching other high schoolers how they did it and how they can do it in their school. Amazing. So this success story to me really is a perfect example of how the youth in our society can really be leaders, because they're not afraid of tackling giant issues. Because of this, kids in school can lead the way. So all of these reasons are why I'm so glad to be speaking in this room today. Today you'll engage in several great workshops on environmental issues. For this lunch hour, I mainly want to talk to you about three things: connection, revolution, and vision. So first of all, connection. As Charlie said, the kids that are in school today will face challenges the world has never seen before. We have to prepare for being able to deal with the new paradigm of environmental sustainability. And we don't even know what the environmental challenges are going to be, even in the coming decades. While we might not know exactly what the extent or challenges of climate change are going to be, we can absolutely prepare to set the stage for understanding the causes and effects and our relationship to these coming problems and why sustainability matters. I think one of the most important things that we can do personally and in teaching others is to make the connections between ourselves as individuals and as groups of human beings and the natural world. To start out, I want to talk about this word, the environment. Okay, so pretend you're not at a sustainability conference right now. Imagine you have been working all day, maybe you're at home, maybe you're in your car driving home, you're just doing your thing, and the word comes up on the radio, the environment. Now, don't think about this too hard. First reaction, what do you think of? This is the classroom part of this. Put up your hands. Yeah. Wilderness.
Camping.
Oh, good one. Yep.
Old growth forest.
Air. Good one. Weather. Health. Climate. Okay, one more.
Slow down.
Slow down. Oh. That's a good one to end on. So I didn't know what your responses would be today, but it's interesting. We heard wilderness, old growth forest, camping, climate. I think that, let's say 2 years ago, but even now, when people think of the environment, they might think of the Amazon rainforest. They might think of an endangered species of whale in an ocean far away. They might think of recycling. That's a big one I get a lot. Oh, you must recycle. You're an environmentalist. People might think of the Kyoto Protocol. They might think of hippies chaining themselves to trees. They might think of David Suzuki. I think that most people have normally thought of the environment as something out there. Yeah, maybe old growth forest, something that was external to our lives in the city, something we didn't really have to deal with in everyday lives, in schools, in dorm rooms, in kitchens, in our communities, in our homes. We didn't think of our environment as our school, as our education system. We didn't think of it as our economic interactions. We didn't think about it as we don't think about it as our plastic wrapped produce that came to the superstore from far away, or the garbage that we put on the curb. In the 20th century, the environment definitely was not thought of as the air that we breathe, or the food that we had for lunch today, and the garbage that we throw away. And I refer to a few years ago because I think that this idea of the environment is actually shifting. It's actually changing. And we did hear that the environment was air, and we did hear that the environment was health. In fact, the definition of environment is simply everything that surrounds us. It's where we exist. We are all human animals in this room. We are acutely dependent on the air that is circling around right now that we are all sharing, the water that was on our tables today, the food that we just ate. We are all deeply connected to each other and to a global environment from which all of these things came. Kids get this right away. When I ask children this question, invariably someone gives me the answer that I'm looking for, which is the environment is everything around us. I make this point because I'm realizing the more I learn about indigenous ecology, which is learning about traditional ways of looking at natural resources, looking at biology, I'm realizing that the very concept of environment or of ecology or even nature may be, in fact, the biggest difference between our Western scientific way of looking at the world and indigenous worldviews around the planet. In indigenous societies, there is no separation between ourselves and the so-called environment or the natural world. In many languages, there's no word for the environment. There's no word for nature. This might seem like a really basic thing. Well, it is. But I think that it is this separation that is actually very fundamental to what our problem is. The idea of ourselves being separate from these basic realities of being a natural creature, from being dependent on ecosystems, inherently teaches us that the environment is external, and it lets us get out of our connection to and our responsibility to ecosystems and people, human beings all around the planet. And this has allowed us to ignore the realities of the cause and effects of our actions in a finite world. In a new sustainable way of living, the basic elements of our connections and dependence on the biological, ecological world need to be retaught. They need to be emphasized. Working these elements of our so-called environment into the things that we're taught are important, like jobs, like food, like economics, like politics, culture, history, working the environment into those realities is an essential practice that will inherently shift what makes logical sense in our mainstream culture. Kids can learn this automatically. Like every single one of you, I am a product of my childhood education. I learned the connections between myself and ecology. I learned about these connections both inside and outside of the classroom. First of all, I learned to love nature. I went to school for a while in Toronto, and even in this urban environment, one of the most strong memories that I have is of my grade one or grade two teacher bringing monarch butterfly caterpillars into the classroom so we could watch them metamorphose from caterpillars into a chrysalis and then into a butterfly. And that is one of the most strong memories that I have. Back in BC, well, I spent most of my time as a kid down in the tide pools in Kitsilano. And I remember once my grade three class did an excursion down to the intertidal zone at low tide. And I know that it's because of the time I spent down there as a kid that ultimately resulted in me doing a master's degree on eelgrass, and an intertidal plant. Second, I learned that ecology was relevant to my belly. I think that for my sister and I, our first environmental education was really about food. We grew up being taught that eating local was the best, and since I can remember, we have gone down right in front of our house in Vancouver and gone fishing for smelt that we can catch in the summertime when they come in to spawn. My grandparents have always lived with us, and Granddad has always kept a garden, and so we grew up gardening with him and eating the vegetables, the fruit, the salad that he grew for us. Third, I learned that healthy ecosystems were essential to cultural well-being. Our parents, our grandparents took Sarika and I all over this province, visiting small communities, many First Nations communities on this coast, with the Heiltsuk of Dolabella, with the Kwagyoth of Alert Bay, and especially on Haida Gwaii, the Queen Charlotte Islands. I was 7 years old when I first went to Haida Gwaii. And when I was 17, I had just graduated from high school. I didn't really know what I was going to do. And I went to stay with Diane Brown, who took me out onto the reefs and onto the ocean, and she showed me that when the tide is out, the table is set. Again, it relates to food. She showed me how to spear sea urchins. She showed me how to gather rock scallops, how to catch salmon and cod and halibut. She showed me about the bounty of the resources that are around us, how it sustains us. And fourth, by simply spending time in these small towns of BC, I also learned that ecological health was ultimately connected to the economic health of these small communities. At the same time as having all these wonderful experiences out in nature, I was, of course, witnessing a lot of destruction. And this was not only the clear cuts, the landslides, the struggling fish runs. This was also in the small BC communities where unemployment was starting to be a big problem as the fishing and forestry industries declined. And I've watched my friends leave their small towns and go for jobs in the cities because there's simply no more future in resource extraction industries. I now know that it's this kind of education, this kind of exposure to these issues and to the environment, not as this external thing, but as relevant to all the things that were important to me, that is definitely why I'm here speaking to you today. This kind of education taught me to respect nature, but also taught me the relevance of our so-called environment. The environment is really about food, and it's really about my friends' parents' jobs. As you know, kids are so influenced by their experiences. They build it into their perspective of the world. And to me, issues of the environment are simply about that. It's about having a perspective on what is going on and the justice that is in our society. In a sustainable education system, the elements of these interconnections between ourselves and the natural world need to be taught. When these connections are made, the case for sustainability becomes crystal clear. And not only that, the solutions start becoming clear. And it sounds so simple, but we have a lot of work to do in making these connections because the 20th century was really about fragmentation. It was about the isolation of different parts of the whole. And now we have to put the world back together again. Interconnections have to be the form and the content of an education system that actually understands what sustainability is. The second thing I wanted to talk to you today about was revolution. In 2008, I think it's finally becoming common knowledge. It's becoming mainstream understanding, at least in a little way, that we are living through a time of immense ecological change that no other humans have ever lived through before. The reality of the fact that the Earth is finite is finally beginning to hit us, even though we've known about the first law of thermodynamics for a long time. it makes sense. In the 21st century, our basic reality is we have to deal with 6.5 human beings on the planet. There are so many challenges, changes occurring. You could say we are living through a time of great revolution. And a very brief revolution, a definition of revolution from good old Wikipedia. A revolution is a drastic change that usually occurs relatively quickly. The word revolution means a turnaround. This may be a change in the social or political institutions over a relatively short period of time, or a major change in its culture or economy. Some revolutions are led by the majority of a populace, others by a small band of revolutionaries. So a revolution is a big, vast change. Worldwide, just as we are experiencing a revolution in access, as the world is opening up in terms of our access to information, our communication with people on the other side of the planet, we are also experiencing a negative revolution in terms of the diversity we have in the world. The obvious one is, of course, biodiversity. 3 years ago, the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment came out. This was a UN report by 1,360 scientists and experts from around the world. And the objective of this report was to assess the consequences of ecosystem decline with respect to human well-being. How was this relevant to people? And one of their many findings was that the current extinction rate was up to 1,000 times greater today than it has been in the fossil record. You might have noticed this yourself. Frogs, insects that you used to see when you were a kid. The world is changing very, very quickly in terms of biodiversity. I've definitely noticed this. The fish, for one, the fishing in the same places where I used to as a kid today is very, very different. And I just started realizing the actual speed of this change two Christmases ago now, when I was standing on the docks just talking to some locals we were talking about all kinds of things, but they started talking about, first about weather and how, you know, they remembered weather from when they were in elementary school. They used to be able to miss school because there was so many snow days, and now they don't have any snow days and they can't skate on the pond like they used to. And then we started talking about fish, and these guys were saying, you know, there are just no fish anymore. When I was a kid, I used to go out to the Bretons and I used to just get these huge rock cod, as many as I wanted. And this might be a normal conversation if these people I'd been talking to had been like 60, 70 years old. But the crazy thing about this conversation was that these were teenagers. They were 16, 17 years old, and this is the kind of conversation we were having. So that kind of tipped me off that things are happening really, really fast. It's not just the animals and plants. There is a deep connection between biodiversity and cultural diversity. Worldwide, there's a general decline of revolution in traditional practices, decline in languages. And studying ethnoecology, I've learned that the ethnosphere, which is a beautiful concept, it's a term for the sum total of human experience, traditions, stories, cultures, knowledge about the planet, the ethnosphere. This is beginning to shrink as the global population urbanizes and we move towards a completely globalized money economy.
You are listening to Severn Cullis Suzuki, an advocate for youth and environmental education, speaking in Vancouver, January 24th.
As ecosystems are degraded, of course, people move from the rural to urban centers, and they leave behind their farms, their traditional practices of cultivation, and this has genetic consequences. Apparently, 75% of the genetic diversity of our agricultural crops has been lost since the beginning of the 20th century. And this is, of course, coupled with the loss of knowledge of how to cultivate those crops. So again, the ethnosphere becoming smaller. Even our economic diversity is decreasing. And I'm sure that you've noticed, if you go pretty much anywhere in the world, you can always eat at a McDonald's. You can probably find a supermarket with the same food that you eat back home. Well, who cares? What's the big deal about all of this? Well, besides being boring, when we study any evolution, any genetics, we know that diversity is the necessary factor for survival, for dealing with unforeseeable challenges to our survival. If you have one huge field of one kind of tomato, you risk being wiped out by a single bug, your whole crop's being wiped out, or some kind of disease. If you have one single type of economy in all the world, and then the United States goes into a recession, everyone connected, obviously, is affected. With more variety, more diversity, you have more chances for dealing with unexpected change, unexpected problems. This revolution in diversity is putting future generations at a terrific, terrible risk. And this is especially relevant to this large specter of climate change. In the 21st century, we are also undergoing a revolution in climate. Climate change is the challenge of our generation. It will be the context for the rest of our lives. This revolution will affect all aspects of our life, and you'll be talking about this in your sessions this afternoon. It will ultimately also affect our security. And I think it's very interesting that a few years ago, in 2004, the Pentagon conducted a report on climate change. And the report that came out stated that climate change had the potential to pose a greater risk to homeland security than terrorism, because it would cause mass migration of environmental refugees and destabilize societies as they compete over dwindling resources. Did any of you hear about this report? Not many. It was not widely publicized, and I think it's worth paying a little bit of attention to. This is from The Observer from February in 2004. The document predicts that abrupt climate change could bring the planet to the edge of anarchy as countries develop a nuclear threat to defend and secure dwindling food, water, and energy supplies. The threat to global stability vastly eclipses that of terrorism, say the few experts privy to its contents. Disruption and conflict will be endemic features of life, concludes the Pentagon analysis. Once again, warfare would define human life. The findings will prove humiliating to the Bush administration, which has repeatedly denied that climate change even exists. This is 2004. Experts say that this will also make unsettling reading for a president who has insisted that national defense is a priority. So that's kind of last statement is interesting, because we can see how much things have shifted in only a few years. But I also raise this because it's a perfect example of how climate change really is an intergenerational crime. This is a massive problem created by older generations that our young people are going to be forced to deal with. On this issue, the people who are in your schools today have absolutely the most at stake. It's so good to see this big shift in consciousness that is happening. It's great to hear George Bush say that, yes, climate change does exist. In the last 2 years, the awareness has been raised to the mainstream. It's an essential subject that we all are part of, and it's absolutely fabulous to see this kind of a gathering happening to discuss it. So the third thing I want to talk about is vision. Here we are, asking each other, asking governments, asking youth, to become more aware that the world is changing, that there are these revolutions happening, that we are seeing a revolution in our climate, that we are having mass extinctions happening today.
Tune in every Tuesday at noon for the best all-Canadian speeches on the local Brown Bagger. Our crew records the authors, guests, and experts as Vancouver speaks. CFRO Co-op Radio's Brown Bagger is your ticket to the best seats in the house. Don't miss the top talks of the town every Tuesday lunch hour, the local Brown Bagger on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Severin Cullis Suzuki spoke to the assembled nations of the world at the United Nations Environment Conference in 1992. As a representative voice for the children of the world, she called the adults to action. Now, as a young woman, Severin spoke to a gathering of school trustees, principals, and educators in Vancouver, Canada. It was a rare public appearance for the daughter of famous broadcaster and naturalist David Suzuki.
The 21st century is a pretty intense time to be a young human being. It can be completely overwhelming. It can be utterly depressing. There's a lot of overwhelming global challenges created by previous generations, but there's also a lot of information about it out there. Not only do these problems exist, but kids can know about them through the media, through the internet. And I remember times as a child listening to the news, listening to adults talk about the state of the world and becoming totally upset about this. And I didn't even have the internet. Kids take these kinds of issues on, as all of you are so familiar with, I'm sure. And actually, I was talking about this to a friend of mine the other day, and he said, "Oh yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. You know that show 3-2-1 Contact? I saw this show when I was a little kid, and it told me that the sun was going to go extinct in 5 billion years. And I got so upset, and I cried to my mom, how am I going to stop the sun from going extinct?" So think about how this is to young people. How do you deal with kids who are totally overwhelmed by global environmental crises? How do we deal with adults who are totally overwhelmed by these crises? Fear and anger without a positive outlet are not good for anyone, let alone youth. To answer these global crises, we need to have vision. Kids today absolutely need to face the reality. Indeed, there are many ecological crises going off right now. But this is not just a massive challenge that we have been saddled with. This is actually also our opportunity. Society doesn't change unless it has to. And now we are finally at that point. We have to change. And therefore, this is the chance to make and create amazing positive changes in our history. In his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, Al Gore spoke of the twin elements that comprise the word crisis in the kanji alphabet. He said, "In the kanji characters used in both Chinese and Japanese, crisis is written with two symbols. The first meaning danger, and the second, opportunity. By facing and removing the danger of the climate crisis, we have the opportunity to gain the moral authority and vision to vastly increase our own capacity to solve other crises that have been too long ignored." I think that what saved me from getting completely depressed as a kid, I mean, just imagine night after night of dinner time conversations with David Suzuki in the 90s. The thing that saved me was the belief that I could do something about the problems. That I, if I was angry about something, I was essential to the solution of that problem. that I was part of an incredible movement of people around the planet that was exciting and powerful, that there was a heck of a lot I could do. And it turns out that motivating and pushing for a more sustainable way of living has become the most exciting, the most motivating feature of my own life. And because of it, I have met incredible people. I have met inspiring individuals who are at once regular people and amazing leaders who are actually changing the world. And that faith I learned as a child is definitely the reason I'm up here on this soapbox today. I know that I am changing the world. I was taught that as a kid, and I still absolutely believe it. For today's child, for a child growing up in a world that is just beginning to wake up to the reality of climate change, there's a lot of doom and gloom. Translate that to a kid's view, there's a lot of evil in the world. And the antidote, of course, is the heroes. And it's the chance to work with a league of heroes. And this vision, this way of looking at these unbelievably big problems, is starting to really become more prevalent. I've seen it starting to grow. There's a whole new language about talking about these problems. There is a whole new vision, a whole new way of thinking. And looking at the sustainability challenge as the most exciting and visionary thing that is happening out there. We need to have this vision, this language, to motivate the transition for kids, sure, but also for ourselves. We have to find the connections between ourselves and the revolutions, and we have to believe the reality that we are the solution. In this moment, every single person matters. In this moment, all of our decisions matter. It will take everyone at every level, in every capacity, every sector, every interest, to take this on and to make the transition to sustainability. And if you look at it that way, you realize we are really lucky to be alive in this time of transition. And all over the country, all over this planet, there is evidence of this growing vision. All over, people are recognizing that they have to take advantage of this opportunity and they have to use it to create the change they want to see. I think of an 8-year-old girl I saw this fall giving a speech to a conference on sustainability. She rattled off 2 dozen things her and her classmates were doing to fight climate change and to help children on the other side of the planet. It was unbelievable. She was so unafraid. She was so practical. She had all the answers. And they did. They seemed so straightforward. I think of Mr. Raul. He was my grade 9 ecology teacher. He taught us about climate change in 1994. I think of Stephanie Bennett, the science teacher at Cochrane High, who initiated the Sustainable Development Project that put the wind turbine up. I think of Charlie, who organized this conference. I think of Wendy Lim, who I just met today, who's doing incredible things in Richmond. I think of Alice Waters and the principal of the Martin Luther King Jr. Middle School in Berkeley, who together established the Edible Schoolyard and the Kitchen Classroom. I think of the young people that are starting to come up out of these institutions, who are starting to form their own education programs. I think of the Campus Climate Challenge, a project of the Energy Action Coalition. The challenge leverages the power of young people to organize on college campuses and high schools across Canada and the U.S. to win 100% clean energy policies at their schools. And it's an incredibly empowering movement. I think of my friend Jessica Lacks, who started the Otesha Project. I think of Karen Kuhn, who started Waterlution, George Roeder, who started Engineers Without Borders, Ben Peterson, who has Journalists for Human Rights, all of these young people who have used what they learned and they've believed in themselves. It's individuals involving themselves in their communities, involving themselves at the levels that they can, stepping up, believing this vision that pushes forward the progress of our human consciousness. So, as people who shape education, your power is vast. You are the visionaries. You are the people who can have the vision. You're the people who can spread it throughout your institutions. You can advocate for outlets for this vision. You can find ways to make your schools sustainable. You can support the teachers. There are so many out there who are already doing this work. You can seek out the role models. You can start campaigns for reducing emissions, reducing ecological footprints of classrooms, whole schools, or your own office. You can challenge the members of your institutions to stand up for the futures of the children in their schools. In conclusion, today you're here to discuss these global issues and how they relate to the opportunities for education in your local capacities. By being here, it's clear that already you've decided you're part of the antidote. You have some amazing experts in your midst. Just in an hour before this talk, I've already learned so much about what is happening in schools. You have some great workshops coming up, some great experts. And just getting everybody together in this room, again, you can just feel this is change happening right here. Some of the ideas you will learn about will be about making and teaching the connections. Some will be about how you can make positive revolutions happen in your schools, in your institutions. And all of them will call on your vision to actually take something away today and actually make something real happen. Sustainability is a challenge both professional and personal. We are at this tipping point stage. We are at this moment of translating will into action. So today, if each of you here take something, one little small thing that you're going to change, whether it's a habit in your own life that will somehow reduce your emissions, reduce your garbage, or whether it's reducing the carbon output of your office, this gathering will have been a success. So you have your work cut out for you, and I am so grateful for you to be here and to be the change. Thank you.
That was Severin Cullis Suzuki addressing a luncheon gathering of top educators, school trustees, and principals in Vancouver, Canada, on January 24, 2008. Through the Green Glass, a climate symposium for education leaders, was organized by the Columbia Institute Center for Civic Governance. Their website is columbiainstitute.ca. This recording was made by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Find more top speeches about the environment for free at our website, ecoshock.org. My thanks to Severin Cullis Suzuki for permission to broadcast this speech. And can we survive without a new green education to encourage a new green generation? We'll be back in just a minute with the original speech given by Severin Suzuki to the United Nations Conference back in 1992 when she was just 13 years old. Tune in every Tuesday at noon for the best all-Canadian speeches on The Local Brown Bagger. Our crew records the authors, guests, and experts as Vancouver speaks. CFRO Co-op Radio's Brown Bagger is your ticket to the best seats in the house. Don't miss the top talks of the town every Tuesday lunch hour, the local brown bagger on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Okay, here is a recording of Severin Cullis Suzuki speaking to the United Nations back in 1992 at the age of 13.
Hello, I'm Severin Suzuki speaking for ECHO, the Environmental Children's Organization. We're a group of 12 and 13-year-olds trying to make a difference. Vanessa Setti, Morgan Geisler, Michelle Quigg, and me. We've raised all the money to come here ourselves, to come 5,000 miles to tell you adults you must change your ways. Coming up here today, I have no hidden agenda. I am fighting for my future. Losing my future is not like losing an election or a few points on the stock market. I am here to speak for all generations to come. I am here to speak on behalf of the starving children around the world whose cries go unheard. I am here to speak for the countless animals dying across this planet because they have nowhere left to go. I am afraid to go out in the sun now because of the holes in our ozone. I am afraid to breathe the air because I don't know what chemicals are in it. I used to go fishing in Vancouver, my home, with my dad, until just a few years ago we found the fish full of cancers. And now we hear of animals and plants going extinct every day, vanishing forever. In my life, I have dreamt of seeing the great herds of wild animals, jungles and rainforests full of birds and butterflies. But now I wonder if they will even exist for my children to see. Did you have to worry of these things when you were my age? All this is happening before our eyes, and yet we act as if we have all the time we want and all the solutions. I'm only a child, and I don't have all the solutions. But I want you to realize, neither do you. You don't know how to fix the holes in our ozone layer. You don't know how to bring the salmon back up in a dead stream. You don't know how to bring back an animal now extinct. And you can't bring back the forest that once grew where there is now a desert. If you don't know how to fix it, please stop breaking it. Here, you may be delegates of your government, business people, organizers, reporters, or politicians. But really, your mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, aunts and uncles, and all of you are someone's child. I'm only a child, yet I know we are all part of a family, 5 billion strong. In fact, 30 million species strong. And borders and governments will never change that. I'm only a child, yet I know we are all in this together and should act as one single world towards one single goal. In my anger, I am not blind, and in my fear, I am not afraid of telling the world how I feel. In my country, you make so much waste. We buy and throw away, buy and throw away, buy and throw away, and yet northern countries will not share with the needy. Even when we have more than enough, we are afraid to share. We are afraid to let go of some of our wealth. In Canada, we live the privileged life, with plenty of food, water, and shelter. We have watches, bicycles, computers, and television sets. The list could go on for 2 days. 2 days ago, here in Brazil, we were shocked when we spent time with some children living on the streets. This is what one child told us. I wish I was rich. And if I were, I would give all the street children food, clothes, medicines, shelter, and love and affection. If a child on the streets who has nothing is willing to share, why are we who have everything still so greedy? I can't stop thinking that these are children my own age, that it makes a tremendous difference where you are born, that I could be one of those children living in the favelas of Rio. I could be a child starving in Somalia, or a victim of war in the Middle East, or a beggar in India. I am only a child, yet I know if all the money spent on war was spent on finding environmental answers, ending poverty, and finding treaties, what a wonderful place this earth would be. At school, even in kindergarten, you teach us how to behave in the world. You teach us to not to fight with others, to work things out, to respect others, to clean up our mess, not to hurt other creatures, to share, not be greedy. Then why do you go out and do the things you tell us not to do? Do not forget why you are attending these conferences, who you're doing this for. We are your own children. You are deciding what kind of a world we are growing up in. Parents should be able to comfort their children by saying, everything's going to be all right. It's not the end of the world. And we're doing the best we can. But I don't think you can say that to us anymore. Are we even on your list of priorities? My dad always says, you are what you do, not what you say. Well, what you do makes me cry at night. You grown-ups say you love us, but I challenge you, please, make your actions reflect your words. Thank you.
And that was Severn Cullis Suzuki, and she was speaking at the United Nations in 1992, at the age of 13, representing the voice of children. Earlier in the program, we heard a slightly older Severn Suzuki speaking at the Columbia Institute at a program called Through the Green Glass, a Climate Symposium for Education Leaders. That was January 24th, 2008. It was good to see a lot of the school trustees and principals and other education organizers talking about climate change and what they can do, especially with green schools and examples for the students on how they can lead green lives. Quite a few of the environment groups were out in the lobby with their suggestions. It looked like a very worthwhile afternoon to me. You're listening to The Brown Bagger here on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. The second keynote speaker at that symposium was Jack Fife, a climate scientist who was a major author of the IPCC report, also works for climate modeling for Environment Canada. And we're going to have just a few words from him to close out the show. So here is Jack Fife, the Canadian scientist.
Thank you, Severn, for the uplifting talk and the great example, great youthful example, which, of course, is, you know, where our future belongs, is in young people, not old, you know, doom and gloom folks like me. The message I'm getting from the program, you know, what I'm understanding your job to be, is to come up and discuss, you know, ways in which your school districts can become carbon neutral, which, of course, is what, you know, the provincial government says you have to do by 2010. In fact, this morning I was at another meeting in the Premier's office to talk about climate change and about this carbon neutral mandate. So, you know, this is all very topical and important. My job, on the other hand, is to convince you that this is a good thing to do. I mean, I'm sure you already all, you know, are convinced of this, but it always bears repeating. And I'm going to do that in three parts. In the first part, I'm going to describe the sort of major dominant changes that have been occurring in the climate system. And that includes the atmosphere, the ocean, and snow and ice, you know, the physical part of our environment. In the second part, I'm going to try to explain why we believe these changes are occurring. And then finally, I'm going to describe what we think is in store for the future if we don't curb our, you know, appetite for carbon. So that's the overall plan. Now, we've already, you know, alluded to the IPCC. Everything I'm going to be talking about here basically comes from this famous report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It was written by 150 lead authors, of which I'm one, involved contributions from many other, you know, leading scientists in the field. It took 5 years of work, you know, a lot of flying around and producing carbon dioxide. Involved scientists from 130 countries and involved a very rigorous review process involving at least 1,000 reviewers. And it's being described as the largest environmental assessment of all time, and it's, you know, part of the reason why the IPCC, along with and jointly with Al Gore, were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, all to our surprise, last year. So that's the, you know, that's where I'm coming from, and I would have brought the book if it wasn't so heavy, you know, just to show you. It's, you know, it's a great massive piece of work. So I'm going to start now describing these changes that we've been seeing, and it's useful to, first of all, you know, look back in time, look at changes we've seen in the distant past to compare the changes we've seen more recently. You know, are they similar, dissimilar? What are the causes of these changes? And we, you know, to look in, you know, into the distant past, we do this with ice cores, most famously the Vostok Ice Core. This is a Russian research station on Antarctica at that location. That's a picture of the station. And then below is an example of one of these ice cores. These are these great long, you know, tubes of ice. Inside the ice are bubbles, and inside the bubbles is a memory of the history of the atmosphere, its temperature and chemical composition. And this is, you know, a great achievement to now have produced in the next slide this record of the chemical composition of the atmosphere going back 650,000 years. And there's more information here than we need now. I just want you to look at the bottom curve, which is temperature and some funny units. And the only point I want to make here is that temperature or change is really the hallmark of the of climate. It is has been changing, you know, for tens, hundreds, millions of years. And you can see that in this trace with temperatures going up and temperatures going down, taking us in and out of various ice ages. Now, this isn't due to any, you know, human influence whatsoever. Of course, we didn't live back then. Rather, it's due to changes in the Earth's orbital parameters. That is, how close or how far away we are from the sun. Okay? So that's looking back in time. And now we're going to, you know, zoom in to the more recent era. In this very famous picture now that takes us back 1,300 years, and again, it's temperature on the vertical axis and time on the horizontal axis, and there are a whole bunch of curves here, each one representing a different indirect measure of temperature. You know, we didn't have thermometers 1,300 years ago, so we have to instead look at, you know, corals and tree rings, ice cores and things like that, and each one of these curves represents a different way of getting temperature out of the natural system. And the only point I want to make is, again, change. You know, climate has been changing. 1,000 years ago, we were in a relatively warm period, the medieval warm period. A few hundred years ago, we were in a relatively cool period, the Little Ice Age, you know, where Europe, you know, skipped a summer. And these changes, too, like the ones we just saw, are not thought to be due to any kind of human influence. These are variations that are due to changes in the solar output, or changes in volcanic activity, changes in natural, you know, forcing of the climate system. Okay, so that again is looking back in time, and now we get to where we are now. Notable in these temperature traces are what we see in the last 150 years with this, you know, rise in temperature faster than anything we've seen in 1,300 years that has taken us to a level of temperature that we haven't seen in 1,300 years. This is, you know, of course, global warming, and this, we believe, is due to, you know, human interference.
That was Canadian climate scientist Jack Fife speaking on January 24, 2008, at a presentation given for educators by the Columbia Institute. That's all the time we have for the local brown bagger. We'll see you next week with more great speeches from Canadian speakers.